Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Welcome, everybody. We are back on track after a short hiatus. We missed two of the parshios, Vayeshev and Miketz. So today we study Vayigash officially, but I'm going to take the liberty to try to incorporate somewhat from Vayeshev and Miketz. Number one, because we don't want the story to be incomplete. But number two, that really Vayeshev, Miketz, and Vayigash are inextricably bound together because they focus on the story of Yosef, Joseph, and his brothers. The split, the dissension, and in this week's Parsha, the eventual reunification. Just a brief overview of the storyline. The last time we met, it was Vayishlach. Yaakov had returned from his sojourn with Laban for 20 years, during which he married four times, had 12 children, 11 boys and one girl so far. The youngest was Yosef, and at that point when Yosef was born, he decided it was time to go back home to Israel. And Yaakov returned to Israel, and he settled there. And immediately we see that Yosef had a special role. He had a special fondness for Yosef. He gave him the coat of many colors. And what ensued from there was what seems to be jealousy or hatred from the other brothers toward him, and causing a conspiracy to either kill him or eventually to sell him as a slave. Yosef went down to Egypt, sold as a slave there. After about 12 years or so, he had endured imprisonment. He was released. He suddenly went to very great heights in the eyes of the king, and he was eventually appointed as second in command, second to the king, because he had predicted a famine, and he also had the solution to the country's faring during that famine. And because of his wisdom, he was selected as the overseer of that whole project. And during that time, he had a chance for his brothers to come down, not knowing that that was Yosef. They came down to seek food. And what ensued in the Parsha of Miketz was a whole strategy of Joseph trapping his brothers, making them into thieves, and then reclaiming what they had stolen and taking a brother as a captive. And then he eventually said, "Do you have any other brothers?" By that time, the last of the 12 sons, Binyamin, had been born. Yaakov did not want him to leave because he thought that he lost his son Yosef. But Yosef, the real Yosef, insisted that Binyamin come, otherwise they would not have the hostage back. And it ends up that Yehuda, one of the leading brothers in this week's Parsha, takes a stand. He stands up to Yosef and he says, "There's no way we are going to let you keep Binyamin." I skipped the fact that they did bring Binyamin finally, and Yosef wanted to take him as a prisoner. And this time Yehuda stands up and says, basically, "Over my dead body, I will fight to the death to take Binyamin back away from you." And at that moment, at the heat of the climax of the story, Yosef reveals himself to his brothers. And he says, "Ani Yosef, I am Yosef, ha'od avicha, is my father still alive?" Anyone who's heard the story is certainly emotionally captivated by it. It's worthy enough of making a Broadway play about it. And it's one of the most dramatic and heart-wrenching stories of the Torah. I listened to the second CD that Dr. Brickman has produced from this class. It was in December of 2002. I listened to it. It was the Parsha Vayigash. And I wanted to hear what we spoke about then. And basically, what we spoke about then is what I want to speak about now. Because I expressed to you then that when I come to the Parshios of Vayeshev, Miketz, and Vayigash, and we read the narrative of Joseph and his brothers, it's just so mind-boggling how brothers, sons of Yaakov, the tribes of the Jewish nation, the forerunners of the tribes of the Jewish nation, should have such animosity. And it's the first time there's a conflict between, quote, religious Jews, if you will. All the other conflicts in the Torah up until now have been between the good guy and the bad guy. All of a sudden, there's conflict. Why would there be conflict between the good guys? I can understand that there's going to be conflict between Isaac and Ishmael, one is a spiritual man, one is a wild man. I can understand that there should be conflict between Jacob and Esau. One sits in the tents of Torah, the other one is a hunter. It's understandable. We have a spiritual mission, you know, the patriarchs, and there are people that don't want anything to do with that. So there's going to be conflict. Understood. But sons of Yaakov, who all believe in one God, who are all devoted and dedicated to the principles that their father lives by and teaches, they are all worthy, and is each one in his own right to be a father of a tribe of Israel. Why should there be conflict? Why should there ever be conflict between Jews? What is the issue that divides us? And on the CD in 2002, I said, please, let us not, in our more mature years, look at this story like we may have done when we were children. And there are these brothers who are sitting in the sandbox, and they were fighting over who gets the shovel and who gets the pail. I'm sorry, you can't continue being satisfied with that type of an explanation. This is the Torah. This is the blueprint for life. There's got to be something profound that is at the root of this discord. And it follows the story from the beginning till the end. So I told you then that there is only one source of information that I have, that I'm familiar with, that deals with this issue. In fact, it's a whole sefer. It deals with the conflict between Yosef and his brothers, primarily Yosef and Yehuda. The whole sefer is devoted to this, but it also encompasses Hanukkah, which I don't know how much I'll be able to get into, but it is a sefer in English called Patterns in Time, written by Rabbi Matthias Weinberg, and he writes a very, very deep book on this topic with many, many sources, which some of the rabbis who wrote on it say are secrets of Torah, inner meaning, etc. So every year I think about this book and I try to understand it a little bit more. I've read it several times. I read it again this year. And maybe a little bit more clarity. But there's something fundamental here that we have to try to discover. I'm going to try to simplify it by focusing on two terms. And that'll be our handle. And I really want to try to walk this through together with you and maybe elicit some participation in this. The two terms that I would like to introduce are the terms klal and prat. Klal, we could define as the all-inclusive, the general, the universal. And prat, we could define as the specific or the compartment of the klal. In other words, anytime you have a body or whatever it may be, a human being or a building or a community or a nation, there is the klal, and there is the prat. There is the universe, and then there are the parts that make up that universe. This, believe it or not, is at the core of the disharmony, the discord between Joseph and his brothers, and according to Rav Weinberg, all profound discords. It's very deep. That certainly doesn't sound so simple to grasp that. But let me share with you from the standpoint of the Chumash where this fits in my understanding. Just to go back a little bit back to the beginning, in the beginning. There's some ideas that we have developed together in the class is that a big change happened with Adam. God created the world. What is the true klal of the world? What is the universe that contains everything else? God. God is the true klal. He contains the world. And at the point of creation, the world was a harmonious, unified oneness of godliness in its every manifestation. This is how we talked about it. When you would see creation, when you would see the garden, when you would see the trees, when you would see man, you would see God. I'm just speaking the words, but it was clear recognition, clear delineation of the godliness. When Adam chose to eat from the tree of knowledge, something happened. There became a separation. Adam became a prat. Adam somehow separated himself from his source. It's like you had a big rock, and you just took a big hammer and chisel, and you cracked that rock, and the rock broke up into many pieces. In philosophical terms, that's what happened. Now it's no longer so easy to see the klal in the prat. If you see a piece of that rock and you just look at it and it's just lying there by itself, all you see is one little rock. You don't see the big mountain that it came from. That's what the world was like. You would look at a tree, and instead of seeing God in the tree, you would just see a tree. When you look at a man or a woman, instead of seeing the hand of God, you would just see a man or a woman. And that's how you felt. You were your own person. You were independent. You were your own man. So there is a division between klal and prat. It used to be that when I would look at my friend, I would see that we were two beings made from the same cloth. Now I don't see that anymore. There's me and there's him. And after the sin of Adam, the unthinkable became thinkable. One person killed another person. These are some of the ideas that we spoke about. And the challenge of the patriarchs and the challenge of life and ultimately the mission of the Jewish people is to try to synthesize the pratim back together so that they become the klal. Or just to put it in simpler terms, we have to see each other as from the same kind, as brothers rather than as separate. We have to look at each other as complementary rather than competitive. Any issue where we separate the prat from the klal, this is a function, this is a result of this breakdown. And we mentioned then that the whole question, maybe the whole question of the Torah, is how do we bring the klal and the prat back together? Now, let's do an exercise and just think about, just project in our own minds, what would it look like if we came forward and we said, I have a solution to the klal-prat problem. Let's just forget about the prat and let's just emphasize the klal. Okay? We're all together. We're all the same. We're all people of God. And let's try to forget our differences. Let's say we were to take that approach and kind of force the klal to be put back together again. Who here thinks that's doable and who thinks that is a good solution? Why or why not?
It won't happen until the Mashiach.
Why? Why can't we make it happen? Why can't we all vote? Let's take a vote.
We're humans.
Yes.
We have frailties and insecurities. And we're not holy enough to do it.
Okay.
And it takes it as a unit rather than as individuals. Therefore, the whole unit has to be pure.
The unit being the universe?
No.
The klal?
The
prat?
The people, the congregation.
Yeah.
You can't have
a pure congregation without pure individuals.
Yeah. It's not a one's pure is good enough thing. It's everybody has to go.
Okay. Yeah.
We're not all the same, and then pretend all the same.
In other words, the analogy of the rock is not really a good one, because in the rock, every single piece of rock is the same, maybe a little different shape, but they're just fragments of the same. The pratim, the individual parts that we're discussing over here, are unique pratim. It could be like, let's say you have a machine, and the machine is made up of 1,000 parts, but they're not all the 1,000 the same parts. Let's say they were all screws. Would you have a machine? No.
Yeah, they have to work properly.
Uh-huh. So the only way we can put the machine together is if we have the right number of different parts all assembled in the right way. If so, how can we, as everyone is saying, you know, reinforcing, how can we say the klal should exclude the prat? We should forget about prat and just think about the klal. If we don't focus on the prat, we will never build the klal. Because the pratim are what makes the klal the klal. And each prat is individual and unique.
And it's more than just doing the right function. It has to be doing it correctly and well, and having the strength to do it, what it's supposed to do.
Correct.
If you have an inferior cog or screw or something, if it doesn't work,
the whole thing doesn't work. Great point. When you're trying to formulate a klal, if any one prat isn't doing its function, nothing's going to work. It's like a team. If one player on the team doesn't do his job, they're going to lose the game. Yeah, Wendy.
How about the possibility that the klal already exists?
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. So you're saying that the breakdown of Klal and Prat may just be an internal one, and what we have to do is realign our perspectives, and we'll see that it's happening. Great, very, very good.
But is it for us to see, or is it Hashem? And if it is for Hashem, well, he knows whether it's functioning properly
yeah,
or not.
But he created the world for us to find the truth. So yes, it's very likely. I mean, it may be in our mind, but because it's in our mind, it probably manifests itself in our actions. You can tell if somebody's not thinking that we're unified, they're not going to act in a unified way. So far we've kind of agreed that to emphasize the klal without emphasizing the prat is not the solution. Let's try the other way around. What if we say that let's just build up the concept of prat? Let's say that every person is unique. Every person should develop his own mind, his own abilities, and everyone is special, and let that be our focus.
Well, that wouldn't work either, because then you'd be like Rabbi Akiva's students.
Then we'd just be a bunch of individuals.
Right.
Highly developed, but not developing into the unified whole. It would be like having a bunch of parts lying on the table that could be a machine, but nobody ever assembled them. So each item here, klal and prat, cannot exist on its own. We see that. And yet, every time you try to emphasize one, it could adversely affect the other. Yes. Wendy offered that because we, in the womb, in utero, we were all taught the Torah, as the Midrash says, therefore we really have it inside of us. Cognitively, we don't remember it. But that says that the work that must be done to synthesize all of this that we're talking about is an internal work. And we really have it within us. You just have to discover it. And Perry, you made a comment on that CD on 2002, in which you said something very similar. You said, what I'm learning from this is that we have to synthesize within ourselves the klal and the prat. But let me get a little more specific into the story. First of all, Rav Matis, there's one part of the book which I think is kind of like the pivot here. And Rabbi Tatz also has a beautiful chapter on this. The individuality, and I forget what the title is, but he talks about the role of individuals in the greater klal. Within every individual reposes a dichotomy which is constantly present to a greater or lesser degree, which is a hallmark of the period of adolescence. In other words, there's a little bit of a struggle inside of each person, and it's mostly pronounced when you're younger. On one hand, we are driven to discover ourselves as individuals. That's the prat. We long to know what makes us different, how we can best express our special selves. We yearn for identity. We are driven toward personal freedom, towards youthful abandon, unrestricted relationships, a celebration of the expression of individual life within a dynamic and physical olam hazeh, this world. This world is multicolored. We have another drive, no less powerful. We seek to relate and to identify with the source and the goal of life, the klal. We desire meaning and significance through the relationship with the eternal, who is the klal, through the transcendence of self. It's not what I want, it's what God wants. This is a drive which demands acknowledgement of reality and assumption of responsibility. At its best, it is a yearning to discover truth, to know God, to find Olam HaBa. Now, those are the two pulls, and they're both within us. And then he goes on to discuss how if a person allows one drive, either one, to dominate exclusively, there will be disastrous results. The self-possession which comes of the harmony of complementary drives is a most difficult attainment. And he brings this back to Adam and eating from the tree. The failure of Adam HaRishon was an expression of his desire to be not a klal, as he was created, but an individual, a prat. His wish was to enhance his capability for self-creation, to extend his opportunities for free choice, to be more an Adam, a man, the purpose of all creation. So he ties it with Adam. Now here he says the downside. Endless search for identity, endless search for pursuing the prat, destroys hope of real accomplishment. Self-expression becomes synonymous with self-dissipation. Relationships with youthful abandon turn into obsessive needs. Ultimately, the monstrous servitude to one's own drives and habit-forming dreams becomes the worship of a golden calf, the lord of pursuit of happiness. In other words, if we just search for ourselves, be ourselves, find our happiness, find our contentment, we're ultimately not going to find it. We're going to self-destruct. The opposite drive may also lead to evil. The attraction of cults is a manifestation of the potential danger to the individual whose entire desire is to lose himself to the greater good. What begins as a quest for meaning ends in the loss of personal significance. Worse, the individual confuses the greater good or the great God with himself. What began as avoidance of self-seeking becomes a camouflage for it, and the humble self becomes a hidden object of egocentric worship of a cause. In other words, if a person starts to say, claw, 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 he may become actually like a self-centered, domineering type of a person, where he was supposedly trying to humble himself, and he actually became monstrous because he made the God into his mantra, and he lost his human qualities. Okay, enough with the philosophical. Rabbi Matthias Weinberg basically says that there is a concept in Judaism, in the Torah, called Malchus. We translate it as kingship. But really, what Malchus is, he says, kingship is not a person, it's not a position, it's really a concept of combining, synthesizing klal with prat. In other words, a true melech is not a dictator. A dictator would be someone who allows his own pratness to be everything that he is, and then everybody has to serve him. He has lost the klal. He's made himself the klal. A person who is not a leader has no way of joining together all of the pratim to form that universal whole. A true melech is someone who respects the different parts and at the same time joins them together. The melech is someone who has mastered the synthesis between the prat and the klal, and truly made the pratim back into that klal. Who are the pictures in Jewish tradition, in the Torah, of melech? Who was that picture of melech? Shlomo? David? Avraham? In a sense, Avraham, before there was a nation, was that melech. Yosef? Yosef was actually the first formal melech, really. I mean, he had the formal authority of a melech. What did he do? He brought his brothers together. He brought the whole world together. He fed them. He organized a system of economy, of saving up during the years of plenty, so that everyone would have food. And he respected individuals. So he was a melech. By the way, the first king of Israel, the real king of the nation Israel, was not King David, it was King Saul. King Saul was a descendant of Binyamin, not Yehuda. Binyamin was a descendant of Rachel, as was Yosef. And it was the nature of Rachel, the more beautiful wife, more suited to Olam Hazeh, to this world, the world of the Prat, which made Yaakov consider her to be his main wife. It was her qualities, together with Yaakov's, which contributed to Yosef and Binyamin's qualities as leaders of Malchus for Olam Hazeh. But the other figurehead in the Torah for Malchus is David. David is a descendant of Yehuda. So really, Yosef and Yehuda represent the two lines of Malchus. Now you can't have two different kings at the same time. There's got to be one leader, one approach. First, it was Shaul. Then, it was David. And that all comes back to Yosef and Yehuda. Yosef and Yehuda both had the qualities of Malchus. First, we needed the Malchus of Yosef, and then we could have the Malchus of Yehuda. The difference was that Yosef, we're introduced to him in the beginning of Vayeshev, when Yosef grows up. All right, these are the Chronicles of Yaakov. Yosef, at the age of 17 years, was a shepherd with his brothers by the flock. He was a youth with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Yosef would bring evil reports about them to their father. Israel loved Yosef more than all his sons, since he was a child of his old age, made himself a fine woolen tunic. Rashi says, by the way, when it says he was a youth, what does it mean he was a youth? He was youthful. Rashi says he was youthful, v'hu na'ar, haya osem masa narus. He did youthful things, like he would comb his hair, like he would pretty his eyes to look beautiful. Yosef was a dreamer. Yosef was young, but he was charismatic. He had dreams one day of being a king. See, Yosef was a master at the prat. The other brothers were alarmed by him. The other brothers felt threatened. They looked at Yosef and they said, Yosef is dangerous. Why did they think Yosef was dangerous?
They thought that his father was a favor and he would disinherit all of them.
Okay, but that's a sandbox interpretation.
He would tell them about his dreams and that they would bow down to him.
According to our explanation, what were they afraid?
Make them his
individual rather than believing in God.
That he would go away from the klal. And they thought that he was a threat to the klal Yisrael. How could Yosef be on top of the brothers? The other brothers were older. They were more established. They more stood for the klal. Yehuda, he was responsible for the other brothers. When there was an incident in Shechem with their sister, the older brothers, Shimon and Levi, they went in and they took responsibility and they didn't care what effect that had. Yaakov actually rebuked them. You know, you made us look bad, but no. The klal is the klal. We have to stand up for what's right. Yehuda is known for admission. He admitted a sin that he had committed. Yehuda's name comes from the word admit. In other words, Yehuda is known for self-effacement and losing himself for the klal. Yosef is the other way. Yosef is the expression of the prat, the expression of beauty, of olam hazeh. He becomes a master of government, a master of economy. He becomes a real olam hazeh leader. Yehuda is more the olam haba picture. And thus, in our tradition, it says that the Mashiach, somebody mentioned the Mashiach, first there will be a Mashiach, descendant of Yosef, but that will be temporary. Then there will be a Mashiach, descended from David. So, in other words, the conflict was, which one is more important? Or which one should be more dominant? Should we emphasize the individual? Should we emphasize the personal? Should we be like Yosef? Or is Yosef a threat to the klal? We should be like Yehuda. And the answer was, we need both. The answer was that in Olam Hazeh, in the world, there is so much allure, there is so much beauty, that we need somebody who can take a hold of that beauty, can appreciate it, can develop it within himself, can deal with people, does not shy away from worldly matters, but beneath the surface, Yosef is Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef is the righteous. Even though he is in his position, he does not fall. He does not succumb to the lures and the seduction of the environment around him. So outwardly, he's a prat. Inwardly, he's a klal. And we need that figure. We need that Yosef. And then there will come a time in the Jewish people's development when Yosef kind of gets us on track that we will be able to be solid enough to be able to welcome in the Malchus, the synthesis that Yehuda provides. What is really happening in these parshios is the brothers are coming to grips. It was a hard pill to swallow that Yosef was a vital player in the scheme of Klal Yisrael. And what happens in Vayigash, Yehuda is ready to demolish, and Yosef reveals himself. He says, I'm still Yosef. And in fact, unfortunately, our father has suffered because of what you did. You were so fixated on the klal, you caused our father great pain. Your malchus wasn't ready for that. I ended up bringing the family together. I ended up being the shining light of righteousness in this galut, in this exile. And Yehuda and Yosef embrace. In other words, it's the acceptance of the two, the prat emphasis with the klal and the klal with the prat, maybe less prominent, coming to embrace the importance of each one. There's a lot more to really flesh this out, but we may find in life that more than we think, These are issues that come up, let's say, with our children. We want our children to go a certain way. You have to belong to this, or you have to accept these principles. You have to be part of the klal. The child doesn't cooperate. The child is screaming out for the prat. What about me? Where's the prat? And so we have to acknowledge that. We have to take a lesson that we have to develop their prat with the right hand and have the klal with the left hand, maybe beneath the surface. We have to be able to walk this tightrope within ourselves also. We have to work towards synthesizing the prat with the klal. Eventually, we do want to come together. We do want to be able to feel good and comfortable with who we are and able to contribute with our unique selves into that greater whole, not to be separate. This is perhaps the major challenge of life. And the reason why there are three parshios devoted to this story, it's not about the sandbox, it's not about brotherly squabbles. It's really about this important dimension of life. I've tried to give it over as best as I can. I think that I said on the CD that I've talked about this before, and I'll probably talk about it again. I'm still at that same point. I've talked about it before, I'll probably talk about it again, but I always come back to this because I believe this underlies one of the major concepts in the Torah.
Cool.
Shkoyach.
Rabbi,
thank you. Yes, sir.
When Joseph identifies himself, he says, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" Is that all?
I mean, what do you mean?
Is that the only inquiry he makes about his father? I mean, one would think it would be in-depth questioning about his father than that.
So Rav Matthias Weinberg explains that question in the following way. It was not a question, it was a rebuke. Let me see if I can find it.
The related question that I had, Rabbi, is I was surprised that he says, "Is my father still alive?" When I would have thought...
Is your father still alive?
Our father.
Our father still alive. Uh-huh.
Him,
that's a good point.
He's asked him previously, though, "Is your father alive?"
Yeah, they told him that he was alive.
But more the question is, why is he saying it now? When he already
yeah, right. In other words, that's why he wasn't really asking, because he didn't know the answer. It was a rhetorical question.
Mm-hmm.
Here's how he says.
He was asking if he was spiritually alive.
Right, right. Yehuda roars at him, "You were toying with our lives all the time, falsely accusing us, pretending to care about your old father, asking only to set your eyes upon our younger brother, feigning interest in our welfare, warmly dining with us while all the time manipulating things so as to have an excuse to keep in Yemen, coldly destroying our father, and now cynically telling us, 'Go in peace to your father.' I will kill you and Pharaoh together. How dare you do this to our father?" And it is here that Yosef delivers his crushing thrust. "I am Yosef. Is my father still alive?" Commentary. How touching, Yehuda, to hear of your newfound concern for our father. Is he indeed still alive after all the pain you caused him? It was you who were always distrustful of youth, my youth, spontaneity, my spontaneity, of love. And that was something that our father recognized as a special quality, yet you did not accept it. It was the solid and dependable Yehuda, Mr. Klal, you who almost destroyed our father, and you had to publicly admit your indiscretion with Tamar. You made a mistake. I, the 17-year-old dreamer, with all my dangerous charisma, I lived my dreams. I failed not with a seductress. I treated you when you were under my power with the care you never showed me," etc. In other words, he's showing you distrusted, you underestimated the power of the individual. Guess what? Were you perfect? Is your approach without my approach good? If you would have had the personal compassion that I have for people, the love of people, you would have thought more about our father back then when you were standing up for the klal. See, really, it's the same in organizations, it's the same in families, it's the same in countries. It's how do you keep focused on the klal, on the mission, without losing sight of the individuals that build up that klal.
Is that response to Yehuda,
yes.
Is that his impression, Midrash? That's not the Tanakh, is it? His response there.
I mean, where does this interpretation come from? It comes from a midrash that says that this was a rebuke.
Yeah.
It was not a question for information. It was a rebuke.
Right. Yeah.
Is our Father still alive after all that you did? Yes. It could be. I don't know if that's the specifically thing, but I think another question, which is a biblical question, which Rabbi Emanuel Feldman writes a lot about, is the question, Ayeka, where are you? That's what God said to Adam. And after he ate from the tree and he became separate from the Klal, Hashem said, Ayeka, where are you? You separated yourself. Are you still part of the Klal? But that question does definitely speak to that.
You know, we also
thank you.
We also are told that Joseph looked very much like Yaakov.
Right.
He
right.
also saw, image was a big thing. He also saw Yaakov's face when he was with Potiphar's wife.
Yes.
But we're told, I think there's a midrash that says that he looked very much like Yaakov.
Mm-hmm.
And I read where that's a rebuke also. Just like you said, it was a rebuke to them. They said those brothers should have recognized him, even with a beard and even with age, they should have recognized who he was. And if
because
they
he looked like the father.
Yeah, and if they didn't, you haven't even been looking straight at your father's eyes.
Ah.
You haven't even...
You would have seen him in me.
Exactly.
Very good. You know, in the last class, we spoke about how Yaakov, there was a little bit of a flaw, how he wasn't able to take charge of Esau, and how he wasn't able to master Olam Hazeh. That's why Yaakov promoted Yosef. And that's why Yaakov said, now that Yosef is born, I can go back and I can face Esau. Yaakov saw in Yosef the continuation of his work, where he had left off, because he realized that in order to conquer Esau, you have to have a strong sense of prat, a strong sense of knowledge of self, and the ability to embrace worldly things, and to synthesize that with the spiritual mission.
I think the proof
it was
of
only Yosef that could do that.
You know, God gives two types of hashkacha. He gives hashkacha
pratis. Very good, very good.
That's a perfect
proof
of
that Hashem works on both on both planes. Great, that's great. Very good. Shkaya. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.